Campus FM presents a talk organized by Palazzo Falson in conjunction with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti entitled 500 Years of the Watch. This talk is delivered by Mr. David Thompson.
Good afternoon and thank you very much for attending this lecture despite the weather. I am sure you will be rewarded by David Thompson's lecture on the history of watches, which promises to be most interesting. David's own interest in watches was sparked off in his teenage years. He followed this interest in both a practical and an academic manner, first training as a clock and watchmaker, and then going on to work in the horological section of the British Museum for the past 30 years, where he has been curator of horology since 1995. David is a vastly experienced horological historian who has specialized in watchmaking in the 16th and 17th centuries. And informed sources tell me that just last week, David was awarded the Clockmakers Company Harrison Gold Medal for services in the dissemination of horological knowledge internationally. He is the author of three books, as well as several studies in specialist publications, and is a fellow of the British Horological Institute, a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries, a liveryman of the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers, as well as lecturing in horological history at West Dean College. In 2008, together with his team, he oversaw the reappraisal and total reorganization of the watch gallery at the British Museum. I am sure he could be induced to reveal several other prestigious memberships and horological achievements, but that might require the use of torture. David very kindly agreed to come to Malta on the invitation of Palazzo Falson and Fondazione Patrimonio Malti to study the small but rather interesting collection of watches at Palazzo Falson. The results of this study will be published in a forthcoming book, which will feature a study on each of the principal collections of Palazzo Falson. Well, since last meeting over here for Jennifer Weirden's excellent talk on Oriental carpets last year, we have had a very exciting year during which we held various activities in the museum, including very well-attended seminars on the Cantilena, organized in conjunction with the Accademia Tal Malti, as well as our first exhibition, which focused on whistles and brought together a collection of 162 whistles loaned from local private and museum collections. Next year also promises to be most exciting and most challenging. We are currently planning, together with the History of Art Department of the University of Malta, a cycle of lectures focusing on different aspects of medieval Maltese architecture. Another series of seminars will be addressed by Professor John Variano of Mount Holyoke College concerning the imagery, symbolism, and cultural relevance of food and wine in paintings, ranging from the erotic to the religious. Two very hot topics right now. Our next exhibition, which we are busy working on, will focus on smoking pipes. But for now, let us just enjoy horology. So over to you, David.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I hope you're comfortable, and thank you for coming out on such a wild night. We thought it would be sunny here this week, but there we are. The weather can be that way. First of all, a big thank you to Palazzo Falson for inviting me and for the Fondazione for having me here, and a special thank you to Francesca Balsan for her wonderful hospitality. So I've got an awful challenge here. I've got 500 years of watches to tell you about, and I've got an hour in which to do it. So I thought I'd start off with what's going on today with my own watch, which is one of these wonderful radio-controlled quartz watches. Some of you may be familiar with them. It tunes in to the international time standard. I'm told an accuracy of 1 second in 30 million years. I decided to call it Conrad, after Conrad Adenauer, the General Secretary, if you remember, Secretary General of the United Nations. because this watch is tuned into British time and I can't get it out of British time, so every time I look at it I have to add an hour on. Thank you. So from there let's go back to the beginning, and we want to look at what was going on in Europe in around 1500. And we can see watches beginning to appear at the beginning of that century. We don't know who invented the watch, and we don't know where. But we do know that they were in existence at the first decade of that century. There's a wonderful reference in a work by Johannes Cochleus entitled Cosmographia Pomponii Mele of 1512, where he describes a young man named Peter Haller who made objects which astonished the most learned mathematicians. Out of very little iron, he assembled timepieces with many wheels, which without any weights and in any position indicated and ran for 40 hours, even if contained in a purse or a pouch. And that really is one of the first references to these small drum-shaped watches based on horizontal drum-case table clocks of the time. And we can see the development of these machines through the 16th century, these little cast drum-shaped cases with cast decoration, chased, often with hunting scenes and so on, in order to make them beautiful. Because don't forget, even then, as we do now, some of us, not me obviously with this thing, but people wore watches to impress people, to show their wealth. People had watches as birthday presents, as anniversary gifts. People bought watches for themselves that they really liked, as we do today. In that respect, the watch has not changed in one single aspect. Dials in those days were simple. Watches had timekeeping properties which we describe today as rubbish. 20 minutes a day, erratic. But somebody owning a watch in 1560, such as this, would not worry about the fact that this watch didn't show accurate, precise time, because people didn't live in that way. So a watch was not just something by which you tell the time. 24-hour dials were common. This watch comes from South Germany, Nuremberg, Augsburg. This was the place where the watch began, although there is some discussion about the watch beginning in the 1490s in northern Italy, but that's something which is a subject of great debate. Iron movements. No brass being used at this time, no screws being used at this time. Basic iron construction. Now I should tell you, and I should let you off something of a hook, that you haven't got to sit there this evening listening to me talking about the technology of the watch. There is just one major piece of technology I have to mention later on, but I'm not going into stack Frieds and fusees and bimetallic compensators and all that stuff and escapements, because I think you need more of an overview, and I basically haven't got time. Here's a lovely portrait which we enjoy a great deal. It's of a man called Konrad Wirt Schwarz, Mr. Black, and he was in Venice, and he kept a journal of his travels. And we're very lucky, because so many of these portraits don't actually tell us that anybody's wearing a watch. There's huge debate about a portrait of Henry VIII, King of England, and whether or not he's wearing a watch. But we know that Fiat is wearing a watch because he says so in the text. He says, "And here you'll see, Dad, that I'm wearing the watch that you gave me last summer, 1557. A very proud thing, and you'll see that he's wearing it around his neck. He has to wear it somewhere. He can't put it in a pocket because he doesn't have one." That comes a little while later. Towards the end of the 16th century, watches took on a more rounded form. The true drum shape disappeared, and watches become rounded in their shape, a Bombay sort of profile. Sorry, the screen's moving. Can you manage with that? You're not all going to get seasick watching, are you? A Bombay shape here, pierced apertures for the hours, a single hand, as you will see from the dial, a silver dial with enameled or waxed chapters, 24-hour chapter ring, as we would expect from a Germanic watch of this period, 1580, 1590, this one made by a man called Hans Schniep in Speer in around 1580. An alarm setting disc. This watch is an alarm watch. Many watches in the 16th century also struck the hours. And the more complex your watch was, the more clout it had when you showed it to your friends. It's a matter of showing off. The mechanism here has brass. I'm moving on really quickly, but we see towards the end of the 16th century the introduction of the use of brass in the mechanics of watches. Clearly the founders of brass got better at it and were able to actually make brass, which was a reliable metal that didn't stress fracture from the forces exerted on it by having a fully wound mainspring somewhere inside. Sorry, I know where inside, but I say somewhere. Very quickly, the art and mystery, as we call it, of watchmaking spread westward from South Germany into France and into Flanders and the southern Netherlands. And I've got an example here dating from 1607 by Jan Janssen Bockelts, who was probably one of the leading watchmakers in Haarlem. He came from Aachen, but he moved to Haarlem quite early on in his career and became one of the leading watchmakers in the area. And you can see here a superb gilded brass-cased watch with a very cheery subject on the cover of the watch, Judith and the head of Holofernes. It's not what you call cheerful, is it, really? You know, you show this to your friends, and how do you explain having that as an icon? I'm not quite sure, but this is the sort of illustration you have on the fine watches of this period. And I should say that what I'm showing you are, to a large extent, some of the finer watches, the decorated watches, because they are the ones which have survived. The plain, ordinary cased watch is the one that tends to be thrown away. And we know this is 1607 because it's dated on the inside. I haven't got a picture of the dated area, but it's dated on the inside to a man called Abraham Ampère, who was a merchant in Haarlem and a close friend of Jan Janssen Bockelts. And we like to think that Jan Janssen gave this watch to his friend Abraham, maybe as a birthday gift, in 1607. You can see a complex dial here with calendar information, the months and the number of days in the month, the age and phase of the moon, and the date here, as well as the time. But still, a single hand, a chapter ring with hours only, sometimes half-hour marks, sometimes a quarter circle. But we're still looking at watches which are relatively inaccurate and have no need of any more precise time indication. In the beginning of the 17th century, we see a change in the way watches are worn. And this is a very charming picture, possibly of a betrothal or a marriage, we don't know. I would say that's the image that's being projected here. And you can see that this unknown lady is wearing an octagonal watch. We've lost the bottom of the picture somewhere. It ought to go down and we would see the key on the end of the chain. Because, of course, all these watches are key wound. And it's the first thing you lose, is the watch key. This picture dating from about 1615, 1620. And here I've put up a watch by a man called Pierre Combray in Lyon, in southern France, southeast France. Lyon, one of the great centres of watchmaking at the beginning of the 17th century. And the iconography on this is various rabbits and figures and the pictures in the middle being related to Susanna and the elders, the story of Susanna and the elders, a biblical subject. And then on the dial, another cheery subject, the stoning of St. Stephen, being watched by a very relaxed group of Renaissance nudes who clearly are not enjoying the scene, shall we say, but it's a rather odd combination of illustration. And the movement, fairly complex movement here, this watch is a striking watch. It has all the gear on the back for striking the hours. A very small, compact little machine. And always bear in mind that in this period, and even earlier, I would say, somebody may contradict me, but I would say that the watch is probably the most complex machine on Earth, and indeed the clock. Perhaps some of the larger astronomical clocks are very complex machines, and I don't think you'll find anything more so than this technology. So these guys were sort of at the front edge of technology at the time, and of mechanics, and if you owned things like this, you would be proud of that aspect too. Because the story of watchmaking is as much about these men who made the machines as it is about the objects as works of art. And that is the delight of them. And it's the story of the people who owned them too. So this beautiful combination of all aspects of art history, social history, mechanics, technology, all brought together in these charming little objects, which are very personal to the people who own them. The only sadness is that we don't know enough about as many people who own them as we would like to. It is a watch, I promise you. It is a watch, and it's made by Jean-Baptiste de Bulle in Geneva in the middle of the 17th century, 1640, maybe 1630. And there was this fashion during this period for watches in the form of other things, seashells, sea urchins, crucifixes. And in the British Museum we have a dog. This lion lives in the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. And it is a charming, tiny little, I would say a lady's watch, in cast silver. But what a lovely expression this sad lion has. And to prove that it is a watch, here you have the dial on the left, the little town scene in the middle of the chapter ring, the usual sort of foliate decoration. I was going to say scrolling foliage then, but my wife has told me I'm not allowed to use that term because I say it all the time. And here the movement, very typical of the period with, again, flowers on the engraved balance cock and so on. Signed Jean-Baptiste de Bulle, and we know he was a Geneva watchmaker. Another aspect which comes into being in the 17th century is the art of painting in enamel, begun by Jean and Henri Tutin in Châteldun in France, who soon moved to Blois, and Blois became the great center of enamel work in pictures. And they always say that in terms of manufacture, the enamelers have the worst job in the world. Every colour, a different time in the fire. You have to be an artist to paint such things. And you have to be a dab hand at running the kiln, because every time you put it back in, there's a chance that all your work will be totally ruined. So these watch cases, these gold, pictorial, polychrome enamels, were the height of fashion and the height of price. This is courtly level. If you can afford one of these, you really are at the top of the tree. And this one, interestingly, is by a London maker, David Bouguet, or Mr. Bucket, as he was known, in the clockmaker's company. A very eminent watchmaker in the sort of 1620-1660 period. He was also an elder in the Huguenot church. He was part of this migration of Huguenots, which began after the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in 1572 and led to a whole influx of makers, of watchmakers, into London in that period. And just before that, we'd seen also an influx of Flemish makers following the, shall we say, the reoccupation of the southern Netherlands by the Spanish armies to reimpose Catholicism on groups of people, many of whom were Anabaptists. And as my former boss of the British Museum in the watch section once said to me, he was Dutch, he said, a lot of these guys were Anabaptists. He said, it can't have been much fun when the Spanish Inquisition arrived. And so they left and they went to places like Geneva, where watchmaking grew up, or they came to London, where the same thing happened. And David Bouguet, Mr. Bucket, was part of that story. It gets better. A beautiful rustic scene in pictorial enamel. As I say, the guy is something of a miniaturist as well as a scientist making his own enamels. Because, of course, you didn't go down the enamel shop and buy enamel. You had to make your own enamels to do this work. And so we're lucky in that respect because you can see different workshops having different palettes in the colours they produced from the subtle differences in the way in which they made their enamel powders. And then if that's not enough, there's 92 diamonds on the cover just to finish it off as a real tour de force of the watchmaker's art. I would say that the case came from France. I think Mr. Bouguet kept his connections with the French enameler watch cases, and that case almost certainly came from Paris. And here the movement, a very elegant, simple watch movement, is a timepiece only, and simply made, but elegantly and beautifully made, and precisely made. It's still a rubbish timekeeper. It will get better. At the other end of the scale, we have watches which we call Puritan watches. This little gold, double-cased Puritan watch, when worn, simply looks like an oval box. And gold in this period is rare in watchmaking. We far more often see silver cases rather than gold ones. It has a date indicator and the time in hours, half hours and quarters. And there's a story that this actual watch belonged to Oliver Cromwell, the great protector, but it's not substantiated. But we do know that it was given to the British Museum in 1786, along with a portrait of Oliver Cromwell. So maybe, who knows? But this is the other side, the simplicity of it, that when you're wearing it, it's not an object of show. It's an object of practicality, of only having the purpose of telling the time. The previous watch by Robert Grinkin Jr., I'm not going to go into too many details about makers. This watch also by Robert Grinkin Jr., a very well-known name in the 17th century in London watchmaking. And here we see a change. The movement is not really any different from the David Bouguet watch of some 10, 15 years earlier, but it has an outer leather case with silver pique stud decoration. It is an everyday watch. And I think, to my mind, the big change is the introduction of the pocket into clothing. You can now wear a watch in a pocket. It's an everyday item. It's robust. It has a leather case. It's not a grand machine. It's the same machine as the others, but it's there for everyday use, and it marks a change in people's attitude to how and where you wear a watch. And you may well see this being worn in the street, in somebody's pocket. Now I do have to talk about a little bit of technology, because the world changes at this point. Now, I imagine, looking around my audience here this evening, some of you have heard of Galileo. Some of you have heard of Leonardo da Vinci. And some of you have heard of Isaac Newton. But I wonder how many of you have heard of Christian Huygens. No? No? Yes? Oh, well done, sirs. Well done. This man changed history. He developed in the 1650s, 1656, 57, the pendulum as applied to a clock as a timekeeping device, which revolutionized the time that clocks could keep from, again, half an hour a day, 20 minutes a day, erratic, to perhaps a fraction of a second a day on the best quality clock to be had at the time in the 1650s. And then he comes along in 1675 and does this. He adds a spiral balance spring to the oscillating balance in a portable timekeeper and changes the accuracy of this machine to something radically different. You could say that this introduction of this technology allowed Harrison to find longitude at sea using chronometers. It is a revolution in science and technology that most people don't know about. So I, as a watchmaker, have to shout and wave the flag for Christian Huygens. There's also another man in London, Dr. Robert Hooke, who was working on the same idea at roughly the same time. But in 1675, history changed. The other problem is that in 1675, every watch that you owned that didn't have this device in it, this spiral spring attached to the balance, became totally obsolete. And you couldn't wear it out and be seen at fashionable occasions wearing such a piece of old rubbish, however pretty it might be. Well, within limits, of course. And so we see the development of watches with the new balance spring. A very short turn, but it is, nevertheless, a revolution in the timekeeping properties of a watch, in this one from about 1680 in London. And it caught on very rapidly around the world of watchmaking and watch ownership. You weren't anybody unless you had a balance spring watch in 1680. They called them pendulum watches because they related to the accuracy of a pendulum clock. A dial has changed now. Silver Champlivet with hours and minutes and concentric hour and minute hands. And it becomes a relatively standard way of doing things, certainly in London. The cases in this period of 1675, 1710, tortoiseshell becomes the stuff of watch cases, very popular device, and often, as you see here, inlaid with silver, here a cornucopia, a squirrel eating a nut, and a bird. It's lovely work, and again, we look perhaps to Huguenots for this work, because we're in a new era. We're in the era of the aftermath of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685, which led to another massive exodus of Huguenot craftsmen from France, and a lot fetched up in London. And families who came from Dieppe in particular specialized in working with ivory and bone and horn and tortoise shell. We call it tortoise, it's actually turtle. I think they favored the hawksbill turtle rather than real little tortoises. You didn't get much shell off a small tortoise. And the amount of these creatures that were hauled out of the Indian Ocean and so on must have been prolific, because there's furniture, everything on earth is covered in tortoise shell in this period. Now, I can't give a talk about the history of watchmaking without mentioning Thomas Tompion of London. He is perhaps the most celebrated of watchmakers, certainly in his time. Many people faked his work. Here he is on the left, and on the right, a watch from about 1688, 89. We debate that from the numbers. But again, a concentric hour a minute hand, but this time a seconds hand. We've even now got to the point where there's a purpose in having a seconds hand on a watch. They're still fairly rare in the 1680s, 1690s, but they do exist. The mechanism, much like the one before, but now it has a different system. It has a regulator where you, as the owner, can play with the going of the watch by putting a key on the square here and turning this disc. You can adjust the rate of the watch to get it to time. Don't forget, of course, you need a sundial to find out what the time is. And then you need to know the equation of time, but I'm not going to go into that this evening. If anyone wants to ask me afterwards, I'll happily answer it. It takes about half an hour. And again, a fine tortoiseshell case, and Tompion's numbering, 1,000, is depicted by a dot in a circle, and number 4. This is watch number 1,004, and to break his code, my colleague at the British Museum broke this code partly through this watch, because he also has two 500s and a 4 on the movement. So it's 500, 1,004 there, and 1,004 there. And the casemaker's mark, Nathaniel Delander. Bear in mind that when you look at a watch, you are not looking at the work of one man. It is the work of a number of people. Other people existed in the world of watches. This is John Bushman of London. Johann Bushman from Augsburg, working in London in the 1690-1700 period. And this is the equivalent at the time of a coronation mug. It's a celebration of William III. It even has the bust of the king on the front. It's a wandering hour watch. I don't have time this evening for wandering hours because I've got to get back to quartz in the 1970s. But the hour numeral wanders around the dial and the next one comes up and so on. the movement is pierced with the arms of the king. And for many years you say, oh, well, this watch must have belonged to King William. But now we're sure that these watches were made for Huguenots, foreign immigrants in London, to express their loyalty to the crown. It was a time when these people were having to sign oaths of allegiance to the monarchy. And what better way than to wear a watch which shows that aspect of your life. There's a wonderful description of a visit to London by Zacharias Conrad Uffenbach, where he says, this is round about sort of 1780, he says, we reached London at dinner time, that is after 2 o'clock, and in the afternoon we went to the famous clockmaker Buschmann. He is a German who had been established first in The Hague and then for many years in England, and makes clocks as good as Mr. Quare or even Mr. Tompion, whose clocks are much more expensive. So go to Mr. Buschmann for a nice... But don't forget, these guys have got to compete with the established London watchmakers who, and someone like Tompion has a reputation throughout Europe, let alone just in England. So Mr. Buschmann's got to do something different. You don't find Tompion making watches with funny dials, but you do find the Huguenot makers doing it. Little extract from a London newspaper, 1709. Lost last Saturday night, the 16th inst, near St. James's Park, a silver pendulum watch, the maker David Lesturgeon, with a silver chain, the pendulum upon the dial plate, with the Queen's head upon the inside plate, and underneath, Reg Incipit 8 Die Martiae 1702. Whoever brings it to Mr. Lesturgeon, watchmaker in Lothbury, shall have one guinea reward and no questions asked. We might have it. This isn't actually the one. The inscription's subtly different. So keep your eyes open, because if you find one of these, you could take it to Mr. Lesturgeon's shop in Lothbury and you get a guinea and no questions asked. This one commemorating the reign of Queen Anne. Similar idea. Side view of the movement. I'm not showing a lot of mechanisms, but I hope you can see the fineness of the pillars. I always wonder how you make this slot in a watch pillar to disappear into nothing. If you use a saw blade, it's going to have a thickness. It's intriguing as to how you pull that saw blade out of there and get the slot to go to nothing at all. Impressive stuff. In France, watches were subtly different. We call them onions because of their shape. They were rather fatter. That's not to say any less fine in their making or in their cases. But they're a different style. And it's interesting to see the Huguenots coming to London and immediately making London-style watches rather than coming to London and starting to make French watches, because at that time a French watch would not sell in London. London was becoming the watch capital of the world. The movement's finely made, finely pierced decoration in the what we call the balance bridge, and the name Gautier à Paris. This is Louis Gautier, a very well-known watchmaker in Paris round about 1700, 1715, that sort of period. Again, wonderful movement work, wonderful pillars, silver applied decoration to give it a bit of clout. It would be like buying a Rolls-Royce with a plastic dashboard. It's got to look the part inside as well as out. And the guys who made these things were proud of what they achieved. Switzerland. What's happening in Switzerland? At the beginning of the 18th century, you can see a downturn in France, a loss of skills. There was an attempt in 1718 to set up a school run by 60 English watchmakers from London to try to reteach the skills in France, because so many of the watchmakers had given up, many Huguenots had left the country, other watchmakers had given up, grandchildren had said, sorry, I'm fed up with this business, I'm not interested in watches. And a very similar thing happened in Switzerland, which had been famous during the 17th century for its fine watches. And this is an aspect of, I don't want to deride Swiss watchmaking in the 18th century, that's not why I'm here, but this is an aspect of what was going on in Switzerland, which has links in England. It's what was, for a long time, called a Dutch forgery. It's signed Wilter, John Wilter, London, and research doesn't show any watchmaker with that name. And it's not London quality. It's not London style. And they are certainly forgeries made in Geneva in the 18th century in the London style. It has an outer case which is signed by Daniel Cochin, who is a celebrated Genevan silversmith who designed and made these watch cases. So in some respects there's no pretense. But in other respects there may be another market. We know at least two high-level London watchmakers who were selling second-quality Swiss-made watches illegally under the counter. So you went to the shop and they said, "Well, sir, I could do you a very fine watch by Mr. Valiamy. How much were you thinking of spending, sir?" "Oh, I see. Oh, well, we do have these." But then if the clockmaker's company came round inspecting the work because they had the right to smash watches which weren't up to standard, you could say, "Well, nothing to do with me. No, no, it's in for repair." "No, no, no, it's not one of mine." "I don't know. Not my business." Ferdinand Berthoud, one of the leading watchmakers in Paris in the second half of the 18th century, a Swiss by birth, but a remarkable maker who wrote a treatise on the whole story of clock and watchmaking and the technology of it in the 1770s. This is a month-going watch with equation of time indication. It is a remarkable machine. We normally think of watches going for one day. A rare watch would be an eight-day watch going for a week, winded once a week. This watch is designed to go for a whole month on a single wind. It's a great achievement. And it's superbly made. And it has quarter repeating. I haven't got time to tell you all the niceties of watches this evening. We could do three or four different talks. But it's got quarter repeating mechanism here. You press the pendant, it will sound the hour and the quarter on a bell inside the case, or tap it in this case. There's no bell, it taps the watch case with the hours and the quarters as single and double blows. And it has the equation of time. Ask me afterwards if you must know. And then the outer case suggests perhaps this must have been something heading for a gentleman of science. We have a microscope, a universal equinoctial sundial, a telescope, an armillary, a pair of dividers, and a book. So we think this, you know, the aim for this is to get to someone, a gentleman of science. Mr. Emery, I put this watch in because it represents a new technology. In 1750 or so, 1748, a man called Thomas Mudge in London invented a new escapement for watches, one which was detached, which produced better timekeeping. And one, if you're wearing a mechanical watch on your wrist today, is still used in a modified form. So we owe the invention to Thomas Mudge in London. Mr. Emery, with the aid of a man called Richard Pendleton, who was one of the leading escapement makers of the time, developed the lever watch and took it towards the next stage. And as I say, it's still with us today. The movement has temperature compensation. The sort of knock-on effect of Harrison's work in chronometers to use at sea had the idea because temperature change is the enemy of a watch. What happens is it affects the elasticity of the balance spring. You don't have to remember, this is no exam afterwards. But here you see a specially designed balance. It's not a wheel anymore, it's a set of bimetallic strips, rather like the thing you would have in an iron which switches it on and off when it gets to the right temperature. It's a moving piece of metal which changes its position in changing temperature. A major step forward, begun by John Harrison, developed by Pierre Leroy in Paris and used and developed in London by the chronometer makers. Now I have to tell you about this watch. This is Robert Robin, and this is one of the stars of the show at the Palazzo Falsan. It is by an eminent watchmaker, chronometer, Robert Robin, and he was born in 1742. He was royal watchmaker. He fell out of fashion during the Revolution, but quickly regained some credibility when he became the horloger du directoire in 1795. And this watch you may see is slightly unusual. It's got a 10-hour dial. It's got 100 minutes on the dial. It shows decimal time. And these watches are rare, and a watch of this quality is an extreme rarity. It has Robin's own detached escapement in it. It is a real treasure in the watchmaking world, and superbly made. It's Robin à Paris number 2. I suspect that this is a second example of his detached lever escapement. And as I say, it had the revolutionary time, decimal time. It was set up in 1793, backdated to 1792, September, and it was basically a year of 360 days divided into 12 months of 30 days plus 5 holidays, because they had to get back roughly to 365 days. It's complicated. This is a calendar. It shows the times of sunrise and sunset and the position of the moon and so on, but each day has a name. It's a complex calendar, and you take a long while to memorize the whole year of names of the revolutionary calendar. And it has days lasting 10 hours. And each hour, if we can call them hours, we can't really, because they're not, are they? But 10 periods, we call them hours. And 100 minutes in each hour. And 100 seconds in each minute. It's a nice idea, but it didn't catch on. Now, I have my own theories about this, and I'm not going to go on to talk about that this evening, but suffice to say that it sort of fell out of fashion in the 1790s, and in 1806, January the 1st, France and all the territories ruled by Napoleon reverted to the normal duodecimal 12-24-hour system. But this is a wonderful, rare survivor, this Robin watch. If you have a chance, do have a look at it, because it's at the palace and it's superb. This is Mr. Thomas Mudge. I talked to you about him inventing the lever escapement in the 1750s. This is a remarkable watch by him, which has a perpetual calendar. And I mean perpetual. So it automatically changes for the short months. And then it automatically changes for the leap years, where February doesn't have an where it does have an extra day. It is a remarkable piece of technology. It is very, very clever inside. That's not easy to do, to have something which only alters in a watch which operates every day, something that only operates on one day every 4 years. That's not simple at all. Here's part of the mechanism behind the dial and the movement, Thomas Mudge. The casemaker, Peter Mounier, one of the Huguenots, still working in London. The families in the 18th century, the Huguenot families, a lot of them specialized in watch casemaking. Pocket chronometer. I'm having to run through this rather. I'm conscious that time is passing. Pocket chronometers come into being. We have John Harrison working on this whole problem of longitude, a lecture in itself. But some of the technology he made was impossible for other people. When his famous chronometer H4 finally proved it could be used to find longitude at sea, keeping time to something like a fifth of a second a day at sea over a period of 6 months, 6 weeks, sorry, is scary. But when the Board of Longitude said, well, how many people can make these things in London? And he said, ooh, three. And how much do they cost? He said, £500. And how long do they take to make? And he said, well, H4 took 3.5 years. And they're thinking, we've got a navy of I don't know how many hundred ships. This isn't going to work. And indeed, there were secrets. When Ferdinand Berthoud returned to Paris, having looked at Harrison's machine, he said to the government, he said, we can't make this in France because we don't know how to pierce the jewels for the bearings for the wheels. We don't know that technology, even though it had been developed in London in 1704 by a Swiss guy called Nicolas Fassio de Douillet and his two French friends, Pierre and Jacob de Beaufort. But it was too complicated. And it fell to people like this man, Thomas Earnshaw, and the guy I'm going to show you next, John Arnold, to make simpler machines, which could be made for 30 guineas and be made in, I don't know, 3 months, and supplied quickly and efficiently by a large number of skilled, trained craftsmen. And this is a spin-off from that. This is a pocket chronometer. So it has all the characteristics of a marine timekeeper, but in pocket size. And this is an interesting one because it's not gilded. Mr. Earnshaw had a major row with Mr. Arnold about who invented the spring detent escapement in the 1780s. And Arnold slagged off Mr. Earnshaw's chronometers, and Earnshaw slagged off Mr. Arnold's chronometers, and Earnshaw said, well, look, you know, all this flim-flam gilding and all that, you don't need that. As long as the proper acting surfaces of the machine are properly finished, it will go perfectly well. And he made a series of watches like this where nothing was gilded and nothing finished in a fancy way. This one was owned rather pleasantly by Charles George Percival, who was Baron Arden and Lord of the Admiralty. And you can see maybe he got the spin-off of knowing Mr. Earnshaw as a supplier of marine chronometers, and that he would have one of Mr. Earnshaw's pocket chronometers as a sign of high taste in high tech at the time. And this one dates from around about 1800 or so. This is a watch paper. You find these inside double-cased watches in the 18th century and into the 19th centuries, usually as advertisements for watchmakers who repair things. So if you took your watch to a party or something, says, who looks after your watch for you? Who repairs it? You say, oh, I can't remember his name. And you could open your watch up and, oh, yes, it's Mr. Mudge in Fleet Street who looks after my watch. You can go and see him. But here is a watch paper showing ownership, which is a nice rarity. This is Mr. Arnold, and a very fine, large, quarter-repeating pocket chronometer by Mr. Arnold. And you can see John Arnold here with his son and his wife. The case of this made by Mary Aveline and Gideon McCare, two Huguenots working in partnership in Soho in London as the case makers. This watch was owned by a wine merchant in King's Lynn. And the details of it were published in a thing called Certificates and Circumstances, where Mr. Everard kept a note of the rate of this thing, and at the end of it he said even when he wore it on horseback it kept perfect time. Now you believe that, you believe anything. A pocket chronometer on horseback is a liability, to say the least. But he says the daily rate of the chronometer is then listed, and it was recorded between November 1785 and March 1790, and it is, to say the least, impressive. It had, between the 11th of March and April the 1st, 1786, a losing rate of 7/10 of a second a day, and a maximum gaining rate of 6/10 of a second a day. When Mr. Earnshaw read this, he said, ha, he said, you believe that, you believe anything. He said, I've heard tell that Mr. Arnold's trying to buy this chronometer back for as much as 300 quid. He'd give anything to get that back in his possession, because he knows as well as I do it won't keep that sort of time, no matter what. They weren't friends. This is the movement of the Arnold again. Temperature compensation devices within the balance. A superbly made machine. If we drool over anything in horology, we drool over things like that Robert Robin machine in the Palazzo. When I saw that, it was rather good. And we drool over this sort of thing. It is absolutely magnificent, high, top-level craftsmanship. It is the best, there's no doubt. Now I need to come to this man, Mr. Abraham Louis Breguet, who had a mixed fortune. He was clockmaker to Louis XVI, not a good title during the Revolution, and indeed he had to leave France and Paris and his business in rather a hurry, and he fetched up in his homeland of Switzerland, where he sat and thought about what he could make in the way of watches to bring his business back should it ever get back to some sort of normality in Paris. And he came up with the idea of these watches, the subscription, where you paid up front a third of the price. And he set this up when he returned to Paris in the late 1790s. And it's a simple watch, single hand, winds through the middle, hours only, with a minute circle around the outside, or let's say 2.5 minutes, roughly, on the calibration. But very elegant watches. And because of all the forging going on, he devised this system here. This inscription is there under the 12. It's been inked in here, so you can see it. It is minute. And it was done from a single pantograph, so all the signatures were the same on the real watches, so that you could know that you had a genuine Breguet watch. And they're beautiful, simple machines. Here's Monsieur Breguet himself, this one dated from about 1798, and it's a simple machine, but it has temperature compensation next to the balance here, a bimetallic strip. And it's elegant. Goes for a day, and you would be somebody if you owned a Breguet. Everybody in Europe owned a Breguet. The Tsar, the Duke of Wellington owned a Breguet. Never mind war with France, you had to have a Breguet. They were the top things of the time. Unfortunately, this is a watch in the Palazzo Falson, which is not a Breguet. It says Breguet on it, but it's a naughty one. It's a Swiss forgery of the period. 1810, Breguet. I think if Breguet saw that in his workshop, he'd stamp on it. A quick word about watches for the Turkish market. This was big business in the 18th century, especially from London, of watches made specifically for export to the Ottoman Empire. And here is an example from the Palazzo Falson by a man called Robert Woodroffe, of whom I know nothing. But it's characteristic of the Turkish market watch, triple cases with the outer of tortoise shell, two silver inner cases, and the numerals, which are a hybrid of Roman and Arabic, understandable to neither party, I'm told by my colleagues in the British Museum, say, well, it's not true Arabic, no one would understand that in Egypt. And we look at it, it's not true Roman either, it's a real strange hybrid, invented, I think, by somebody in London somewhere around about sort of 1740, maybe a bit earlier. Here's another one in the British Museum collections by a man called Josiah Bartholomew, and it has all the same characteristics, it's rather larger, but it's just a second example of that sort of thing. And what's nice about this watch is the whole thing was made in Red Lion Street in Clerkenwell. We have Bartholomew there at number 25. We have Joseph Glennie, his mark there. He was number 20. And Michael Thomas Atkins, the man who made the top pendant bit there, he was down at number 1. So you could pretty well see that all this watch comes from Red Lion Street in Clerkenwell. And this is something I want to emphasise, that when you look at a watch, as I say, it's not one person. It's case makers. It's secret springers. It's escapement makers. It's frame makers. It's pendant makers, it's dial enamelers. And indeed, in a report to the British government in 1804, I think it was 1804, they listed in England, the way things were going, 104 separate trades involved in making a watch. So when you have a watch by Josiah Bartholomew, you're looking at something which has pillars made by a specialist pillar maker. There were people who only made the centre wheel for the machine, the fusee maker, the secret springers, and so on. It is not one man working in a dim workshop with a bucket of scrap metal at one end of the bench and a fine watch like this coming from his hands at the other. It is a combination of a huge number of diverse skills and talents. I better speed up a bit, hadn't I? Jean-Antoine Lepine, famous Parisian maker. This is Lepine Paris, à Paris. We don't know. There's a great dynasty of Lepine makers in Paris, and I can't tell you who made this, but it's typical of Paris of the 1760s. It has a sort of coloured gold case, which is a very common way of finishing cases at that time, a sort of pastel scenery with sheep and so on, and water, an aqueduct with water flowing out. It's a charming little lady's watch of about 1760. This is a rather more important watch by Jean-Antoine Lepine, with very unusual chapters, strangely combination of Roman and Arabic. We've got a V and 3 for 8 and a V and 2 for 7. Most unusual and peculiar to Jean-Antoine Lepine. The reason I show it is because Lepine developed a new form of mechanism where you stuck the components under little cocks and bridges so that you could take it apart easily. It's not one of these horrible things we call full plate movements where you have one plate at the top which holds everything in and you have to be trained as a watchmaker to put it all together. You could even train women to put these watches together. It's amazing. Sorry, I jest, of course. But that was the idea, to make it simpler to manufacture, simpler to assemble, where you didn't have to employ so many skilled craftspeople in the manufacture of them. Another one from the Palazzo. This one, again, a typical example of an 18th century watch, late 18th century, early 19th century, 1790, 1800, with an enamel dial showing here earth, air, fire and water. We only tweaked it yesterday. Is the earth, the fire's there, the water's here, and this is the air, the blowing in the wind over there. It's a very nice little combination of the four elements. And an English watch, much the same period, a little bit later, 1814, very standard, unfortunately missing its hands, but a typical London, diversely made watch of this period, with all these people involved in its manufacture. And I simply point out here the casemaker, because we can have a guess at who that might be. In this case, it's someone called Samuel Brough, S.B. Chinese market is another one. Very kindly, a lady earlier on showed me a watch, and I said, oh, this is Chinese market. It was very characteristic of the style of Chinese market watches. And here we have two watches in a presentation case. And you think, why two watches? Another thing to notice, two keys, of course. You could use one to wind both, but two keys. Two mainsprings. And underneath the watches, there are two spare glasses. Now, you have to remember, this watch is made in Fleurier in Switzerland. It's taken to Canton. It takes a while to go to Canton. I believe it's about 6 months by ship. So if you break your watch glass in Beijing, Peking, you've got to order a new one. It's got the message to you want a new glass has got to come back. That's 6 months. It's got to be put back on another boat and get back out. It's a year before you get your new glass for your watch or your new mainspring, which is another thing that commonly breaks. So they thought about that and they supplied spares, ready and available. Beautiful twin portraits on the back of the watches. Chinese taste for having pairs of things is catered for here. And then the movement, and I'm sure the lady will see the characteristic shape of these components. And I said immediately, this watch comes from Fleurier. This is the style of the Fleurier watch in the 1820s, 1840s. And this elaborate decoration on all the components is again for the Chinese taste. You can have thin watches in the 1830s and 40s, remarkably thin watches. And this watch is, well, about 50 millimetres diameter. And if the actual case is that thick, you have to dream about how small the components are inside. It's quite scary. It's a digital dial. People might think of digital dials being a modern convention, but here you can see two discs, rotating discs, for the hours and minutes, which appear in apertures in the dial. A very elegant lady's watch from a Swiss firm in about 1830. This is another rather charming watch and one of my favourites. This is Breguet again. It's not Abraham Louis. It is this is Breguet et Fils, the company which carried on and still in existence today. But this is a lovely little lady's watch with all the features of a finely made Breguet watch of the period, and it's dated 1844. And the reason it's dated 1844 is because it belonged to somebody rather special. And it has a signed portrait of this lady, the Grand Duchess Olga, who was Nikolaevna Romanov, Grand Duchess of Russia, second daughter of Tsar Nicholas I. She was born in 1822, and she married Crown Prince Karl, who became King of Württemberg. She was born on the 30th of August, 1822. This watch is dated the 30th of August, 1844, and it was collected from Breguet's. We know Breguet's records survive of who made the watches, who the craftsmen were, how much they were paid for their part in the job. And we know who collected them, who paid, who bought the watches, who commissioned them. And this one was collected on the 24th of July, 1844, by the Grand Duchess Alexandra, Olga's sister. And I reckon this was a 22nd birthday present from Olga's sister Alexandra. It's a lovely little thing. And it has the Russian royal arms on the case. We're getting there. Now I have to change tack. Now I should explain and perhaps apologize that I'm not going to speak at length about the major Swiss houses of watches of the 20th century, because I've got some other things to tell you which I think have to be told before that. This man is a man called Pierre Frederick Angold, came from Switzerland, went to London in 1842 and tried to set up a business called the British Watch and Clock Manufacturing Company. And his idea that was you make machines to make the parts for watches. You don't pay skilled craftsmen to make individual components. You pay the skilled craftsmen to make machines to make the components, and then every wheel will fit every watch. And he did that. He tried that in London. He claimed that he could make something like 400 watch movements in the time it took the standard trade to make four. And he proved that it could be done with a degree of precision. And the British establishment froze him out. They said, we don't want this here. This is not the way things are going to work. And he went to America. He didn't last long there. He was only there for about 6 months, and he went back to Switzerland. And although he'd not found a lot of joy in Switzerland in his first attempts at this, when he got back, they thought, this is a good idea. We can employ unskilled labour to assemble watches and only have maybe one finisher looking after the adjustments and adjustments of the escapements and so on. We can cut down the manufacturing costs no end. We can make thousands of watches. And they did. And the British didn't. And this is an example, a rare example, from the British watch and clock manufacturers. It's Simon Wagstaff, who we think bought up some of the stock when the factory was bankrupted and shut down. We think Wagstaff got hold of some of the movements, because this is absolutely characteristic of one of those machines. In England, they were doing this. This is what you could buy as a watchmaker. You could phone up Prescott in Liverpool and order a load of these rough, unfinished movements, which would be sent down to your workshops to have the escapements added, to be gilded, to be engraved, and so on. Or you could get to Switzerland and order movements from Switzerland, and you could have your name put on them. So the more this story develops in the 19th century, the less involved is the actual person who puts his name on the machine. That's not always true. There are exceptions, of course. There are great watchmakers in all centuries who are obsessed with the idea of improving things and making fine individual watches. But for the mass production of watches, this is the way things go. And in England, it's this. In Switzerland and in America, it's the machine production of watches. A lot of them very good quality too. It's not necessarily saying because it's machine made it isn't any good. That isn't how you should view it. Some of them aren't any good, but a lot were. Depends on the design and the precision in the manufacture. This man comes along, Mr. Roscoff. He was Swiss, and he decided he wanted to make the watch for every man. And he decided he wanted to manufacture watches for 50 Swiss francs, maximum price. And he succeeded, and he patented his methods of making really cheap, mass-produced watches that anyone could afford, even with paper dials, glued-on paper dials, which one would see as insignificant and low quality, but nevertheless it allowed a watch to go down to a different level in the social scale. And don't forget that watches could be bought at different levels because there's always a second-hand market. It's like cars today. You can have a brand new car, or you can buy a second-hand one, or you can go down the pub on a Saturday night and find someone who's maybe found one in a back street somewhere, which is really all right, you know. It does work. And it isn't stolen, I promise. So that's how you can see watches as well, in that light. It's not only about brand new watches. There's the movement, as you can see. It is no thing of great beauty. And then the Americans took it up, and this is an Auburndale rotary watch. It was a failure. This watch was a failure. 1880s, this was happening. And very few watches were made. About 1,000 watches were made before this factory went bankrupt because their technology was wrong and the watches were unreliable. And they only actually finished about 500 of them with cases. So very rare things, but this marks the beginning, perhaps, of the American story. And this is how America went. This is not watchmaking in small little workshops with batch production. This is huge manufacture. And by the time we get to the sort of 1890s, 1900, some of these guys were producing millions of watches. And they got the price down to as little as a dollar for a watch. And it really did mark the beginning of the watch for everybody in the sort of industrialized world. This is a contrast. I put this in because I think the two go together. There's the Elgin Watch Factory in America in the 1880s. There's a little clockmaker's workshop in Flanders in 1580s. You can see things have changed somewhat. This is the sort of thing they were making for a dollar in the New England Watch Company, turn of the 20th century. Very simple, machine-pressed components, stamped out, nothing spectacular or fine about this watch, but they work. An awful lot of them still go today. It's quite scary, really, because they shouldn't. And then the wristwatch. I'm not going to do a lot on the 20th century and the 21st, because it's another story, and as you were told earlier, I really specialize in the 16th and 17th century, so this is strange stuff for me. But this is a relatively early wristwatch. The first examples of wristwatches come in the sort of 1880s. There's evidence of Girard Perregaux in Switzerland supplying the Austrian Navy, of all people, in the 1880s with wristwatches. The Jules Cartier were making wristwatches at much the same time. But there's great debate about where the wristwatch really started and who were the first. And one which I'm not going to go into. But this decries its early origins in having the winding button still at 12. This company are still using up pocket watch cased pocket watch movements, and they've added a couple of lugs onto it and put a strap on it and turned it into a wristwatch. Another aspect, I think, was perhaps cycling, bicycles for ladies. You could buy leather wrist adapters where you could take your pendant watch off and put it in a wrist strap so you could wear it when you went out on your bicycle on a Sunday afternoon. And wristwatches, I think, before World War I were very much a girly thing. Men would not be seen wearing a wristwatch in 1890, 1900. Not really very proper thing to do. But the use of them in the First World War, in a clearly practical concept, changed all that, and the wristwatch became the thing of the moment, and then everybody went to seeing that the wristwatch was a far more convenient way to do things. The next step was Mr. Harwood in 1923, who after years of struggle managed to patent a method of automatically winding a wristwatch successfully. And this is an example of his patent watch with an oscillating weight which keeps the watch wound simply by wearing it. The movement of that weight is what winds the mainspring. This is 1923 patent. This is a 1929 example. And you set the hands by turning the bezel, and you have a little red dot. And if it's on the red, it's in set hand position. And then you turn it the other way, and the black dot comes out, and you then know it's in the winding position. Very subtle little device. Jumping forward post-war to the Jaeger-LeCoultre Futurematic, which was the first, as far as I know, I'm making this up, of course, the first automatic wristwatch in which the oscillating weight wound in both directions. The Harwood only wound when the weight went one way. this one was one where the weight moves in two directions and it winds both. And then, of course, the next step, which I haven't got here, is the rotary weight, which goes around complete circle and winds the watch in both directions. And then the Bulova Accutron. Is anyone familiar with the Accutron? Very famous watch. Using a tuning fork as the timekeeping device, an electromagnetically vibrated tuning fork, which is used as the timekeeping element, and usually they chose a frequency of 360 vibrations per second. And it actually has a mechanical wheel in it which is moved by the tuning fork. And the real difficulty with that was making a wheel with fine enough teeth that could be moved accurately by the oscillation of a tuning fork moving at 360 vibrations per second. It's not what I know. The electric watch comes in. Fred Lip in France and Hamilton's in America in 1968 pioneered the first electromechanical watches, which is the other way around. This should have two great big batteries in here, where normally the mechanical watch with a mainspring, the balance is the thing that wags at the end of it that keeps the time, but it doesn't drive the watch. With these watches, it's all the other way around, and the balance is electromagnetically impulsed, and the actual oscillating balance drives the rest of the watch train. It's all back to front for me, but a step forward. As I say, Hamilton's in America, Fred Lip in France, in 1968, developed this new technology. And of course, this all relied on an important, vital, I nearly forgot to tell you, development in technology. Have you heard of Samuel Rubin? Have you heard of Philip Mallory? You couldn't have any of this without their development of the miniature electric cell, the miniature battery. All of this relied on their development of tiny little batteries which would produce enough power for a long enough period to make this viable. And it was their work that allowed that to happen in the 1950s. And then these. You're familiar with these. You probably remember them. Awful things. You had to press the button on the side and the dial lit up. Major step forward in technology, though. The quartz oscillator. Known in clocks in the 1930s and even earlier as a timekeeping element. And then developed in watches in the 1970s. Again, Hamilton's was one of the main characters. But then we see the Japanese coming in on the story. And basically, you take a quartz crystal, you pass a low electric current, I hope I've got this right, you pass a low voltage electric current through it. The crystal is usually shaped like a tuning fork. If you get it right, the crystal will oscillate at 32,768 vibrations per second. And because of the piezoelectric effect, it will emit a very high frequency electric impulse at 32,760 times a second, and it's a very constant rate. This is the new timekeeping element for watches, and many of you, I'm sure, today are sitting here with this going on in your watch day. You can hear it buzzing, and then you electronically divide that number down until you get one impulse per second, and you use that to trigger the low voltage circuit to operate a stepping motor which will turn the hands, or to operate these wonderful liquid crystal displays which show you the time in numbers. And that brings me back to where I started, to this, which is an hour wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, David. I really don't know how you managed to cram 5 centuries of the development of the watch into a bit more than an hour, and it's not even a decimal hour. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank
you. You have just listened to a talk organized by Palazzo Falson in conjunction with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti entitled 500 Years of the Watch. This talk was delivered by Mr. David Thompson.